Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of my favorite resources in this war for the free world is a man we're going to have the privilege of speaking with at length today for a full hour. He is Ami Horowitz. He is best known, I think, for his various examples of what he calls gonzo journalism, notably a 2009 documentary entitled You and Me, and most recently an extraordinarily impressive drill down on the nature and extent of the malevolence of the Muslim Brotherhood, entitled Inside the Muslim Brotherhood. Ami Horowitz, it is a real delight to have you back, and thank you so much for giving us a full hour of your time. I couldn't be more pleased to be able to discuss all of these issues and more with you at length.
It's always a pleasure, Frank. Thank you. And by the way, don't forget, you appeared in You and Me. And in fact, if I recall that particular interview in that day, we sat down with Frank and we interviewed him, and I have a whole crew there, you know, lighting crew and PAs and, you know, camera guy and sound guy. And I remember after we were done, they were thoroughly depressed. All day. You were able to depress this crew of people thinking the world is going to end in the next few weeks unless we do something. So my hat's off to you.
Well, this is my job, after all. That's what we do a lot of here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for recalling that. I should mention, before we get too much further in this, and we're going to talk a bit about it in the course of our conversation, you are also a declared candidate for the Democratic nomination for the presidency of the United States. Talk about hats off. Hats off to the man in the arena. Congratulations and well done. We'll look forward to hearing more about it in a moment. But before we do that, just tell us for, you know, scene-setting purposes, I guess you'd say, in the documentary film business, a bit more about your background, Ami. How did you come to get into the documentary filmmaking business in the first instance, and maybe a little bit about sort of this theme that seems to be running through a lot of your oeuvre, as they say in Hollywood, of, you know, taking a very critical and, I think, quite rigorous view of institutions like the United Nations and a variety of other politically incorrect topics.
Yeah, well, I made the natural and generally accepted transition of investment banker to gonzo filmmaker. So it's a well-treaded road done by many people before me, from Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and the like. You know, it's funny. I was an investment banker for that. Well, you know, you really want to take a step back. You know, my career has the major mark of my careers, my different career paths, and I've had a number of them, has been going out of my comfort zone and doing things I have absolutely no experience or business being involved in. And I remember that my first job out of college was running a campaign manager for the state controller of Maryland. I'd never had any campaign experience whatsoever, but somehow finagled myself in that position, and we lost. And afterwards, the guy who was my candidate was a investment banker at Goldman Sachs, and he said, you know, my suggestion is, why don't you leave politics? Otherwise, you're going to be living hand to mouth. Go make money in investment banking, and then come back to politics. And I said, that sounds great. How do you make money? He goes, become an investment banker. I'm like, great. What's an investment banker? He goes, you'll figure it out. That was the extent of his advice. I literally moved to New York, didn't really know what an investment banking really was, never took a business class. And I sat in a phone booth with a phone book. Back then they used to have phone books, with a list of investment banks. I just cold called them until I found somebody who was willing to hire me. And I had a career for 12 years as an investment banker, finally figured out what it was. And then kind of got bored and didn't feel, you know, it never felt totally comfortable for me. You know, it was a good living, but wanted to do something a little more meaningful. And just one morning decided to wake up and make a movie. Had absolutely no experience whatsoever in making films or movies other than being born in Los Angeles. I guess that's my only...
Well, you did go to USC. That's University of Southern California. It's got a pretty impressive film school. You just didn't happen to spend any time there.
Just happened to attend. Yeah, exactly right. And then, you know what? I woke up and 12 years later, I've had a successful career at this as well. So, yeah, that's kind of been the trajectory of my career. So who knows what will come next? I guess politics, going back to becoming president.
Well, I'm sure there are people who say you don't have any business doing that either, but we'll talk more about that in a moment. But just to tie this all up, you wound up getting a cold call that got you into a job at Lehman Brothers, which is a pretty impressive investment bank. Unfortunately, no longer with us. That's another story. But I did want to just ask you before we get into, you know, the film making and the topics that you've chosen to make films about. Give us just a sense of your sort of political philosophy. As I say, you're running as a Democrat, but you wouldn't certainly fit into the Democratic Party as it's been increasingly framed by the other candidates for the presidency, to say nothing of the so-called squad on Capitol Hill. I'm an old Scoop Jackson Democrat, and it seems to me you're kind of in that mold. Is that about right?
What makes you think I wouldn't fit in with Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and AOC? And why would I not fit in comfortably with them? Come on, man.
Well, I think my guess is that they wouldn't want to be seen in your company, among other things, but mostly because you're way too sensible and you've generally taken over these years a very robust view of both America's, you know, sort of character and policy interests around the world, none of which they would certainly share.
Look, let's be honest here. Have I ever voted for a Democrat for president? No. Do I fit comfortably in the mold of a Democrat? No. But I did it, obviously, because I wanted to find a platform to point out the absolute insanity of this incarnation of the Democratic Party. You know, look, I know that I'm not going to make the debate stage. Obviously, I was trying to do that to highlight that point in their own house. But I'll tell you who also is not on the debate stage, but should be on the debate stage, is the squad, because they're all dancing to their tune. Make no mistake about it. The policy prescriptions that you're hearing on that debate stage is not the policy prescriptions that, by the way, a number of those people on the stage actually believe in, but they're saying it because they have the Democratic Party has warped political physics so much, and they've moved the center of gravity so far to the left in such a short period of time. We've never seen anything like that in our modern political history.
No, I think that's right. I mean, hold the thought, because we're going to come back to a much longer conversation about this particular topic. Ami Horowitz is our guest. Much more of all of this straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back for the second installment of this hour-long conversation with an extraordinary, enterprising, and very courageous man, Ami Horowitz. Ami, among other things, is the driving force behind a new mini documentary on the Muslim Brotherhood. And Ami, I wanted to just first of all say congratulations on doing a very thoughtful and serious assessment of this entity that is, I would argue, the serious leading edge of the jihad worldwide, including in our own country, and is seriously underestimated as such by policymakers and I think most in the public as well. Tell us a little bit about what the Brotherhood is, how it has come to enjoy the kind of influence and well, power that it does around the world, including here.
Yeah, first let me say how much it means to me to have you say those kind words about this video, and I'll tell you why. Look, not only do I respect you as a thinker and a thought leader, but the work that you've done this particular issue is incredible, and you've been a leader on this issue. And I know what I am. I'm an interloper. I'm somebody who kind of came in, you know, did my thing and kind of walked away from it. And this is something that you have eaten and you have breathed and you have lived for and been talking about for years. So to have you say those kind words about that video means a lot to me. So thank you for that, Frank.
They're heartfelt and more to the point, they're well deserved. So carry on.
So look, this is Muslim Brotherhood. So the organization started by a guy named Albana in Egypt. And the thinking at the time, Islam was facing an extraordinary changing of the tectonic landscape for them. A number of factors were coming around the same time. World War I had just ended. It had ended the realm of the Ottomans, which was kind of the last gasp of the Islamic control and the Turkish control of the Middle East. And modernity has now, with the 20th century, kind of creeped in to the world. And these were all massive challenges that Islam was facing at the beginning of the 20th century. And Albana kind of looked at that and felt that Islam was falling fallow, that Egypt in particular was falling prey to the modernity that was encroaching all around the Middle East. And he felt that he wanted to create a pure form of Islam to bring people back to traditional, in his mind, traditional Islam. And he created an organization called the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood was meant to be a pure form of Islam to bring people back to traditional ways. And that's kind of what they started out as. It has fast forward now, you know, through the decades. And what we look at now is the Muslim Brotherhood, the single largest organization, Islamic organization in the world. And it really cuts across a whole lot of different stratas. It is very political, and it's, by the way, it's in almost every country in the world, not just the Islamic world, but it is involved in politics across the Middle East. It's involved in social services and charities across the Middle East. And, oh, by the way, it's also involved in violence and terror as well.
I want to talk with you in a moment about how it operates, but just to stitch this into what we're going to be talking about throughout the rest of the program. The idea of the centrality of Islam and its need to return to its roots is sort of central to the Muslim Brotherhood program. Can you just reprise for us, paraphrase if you need to, the creed of the Muslim Brotherhood to help calibrate the character of this, I call it Sharia supremacist enterprise.
I think that's actually kind of important when the detractors of people like us who try to explain what the Muslim Brotherhood is about, they will always say that, hey, you know, you guys are really overstating their radicalism. They're really not that radical. I mean, I think the credo is important. I'm going by memory here. It's the Allah is our leader, or Allah is our the Prophet is our leader, the Quran is our law, jihad is our way, and I think dying for Allah is our highest hope. I believe that's their motto.
It's pretty close. And the point is that it is absolutely clear that it is committed to jihad to establish the supremacy of Sharia, this Islamic totalitarian code worldwide, right?
It's right there, right? It's right there. Jihad is our way. Now, remember, you will a lot of time, and I don't get too far, and if we're getting too far into the weeds here, let me know and just pull me right back out. But of course, you will always, when somebody's trying to poke holes in our argument, they will always go back, particularly when it comes to jihad, and they'll say, well, you misunderstand what jihad is. Jihad is really more of an internal struggle about trying to find your way in Islam. And look, is that one of the understandings of the word jihad? Yes, it is not the understanding of the way jihad is used in the motto of the Muslim Brotherhood and way we Islam has understood jihad in the modern sense. Jihad is, in fact, truly a violent violent path that they're trying. In fact, that's why the motto specifically says right after jihad is our way is that dying for Allah is our highest hope. Okay, you don't die when you're trying to when you're having an internal struggle with yourself. You die when you're having an external violent struggle with somebody else.
Yeah,
and that's why it's important to make that note.
It's really critical. And I did just want to though inject, and I think your film speaks to this very powerfully, that in circumstances in which it is not possible to use violence effectively, there is a tradition dating back to Muhammad that the Brotherhood, of course, practices relentlessly of using other forms of jihad. One of their leaders has called it civilization jihad to advance the same ultimate objective of the triumph of Sharia. Tell us a bit about that part of the Brotherhood's playbook.
The Muslim Brotherhood, and the reason why we called it Inside the Muslim Brotherhood is because we really went inside the Muslim Brotherhood. I traveled to Istanbul and Beirut and Cairo and Berlin and the United States interviewing Brotherhood leaders. Not all of them end up agreeing to being on camera, but we spent a lot of time speaking with them. And of course, had some of them were on camera. And you know, one of the leaders kind of said it perfectly, and he's based in Istanbul, formerly Egyptian. And he said, look, they truly believe that Islam is a supreme organization. Now, of course, everybody believes I'm a Western supremacist. I believe that the Western modernity is the way of the future for the world. And he believes that Islam is supreme. Now he and I both, in the sense of the cultural sense, yeah, of course, I and he both agree that when on a level playing field, of course, I believe Western democracy is going to win out, and he believes that Islam is going to win out. The difference is, of course, that I'm not willing to force you into my ideology, and then if you don't accept it, I will kill you. That, of course, is the way the slight difference in where we separate,
rather
ideologically speaking.
I'd say maybe slight,
yeah, a little bit,
rather significant.
But they do believe that the U.S. and they spoke about the U.S. itself, that the U.S. is morally corrupt, and that it is soon going to fall under its own immorality. And with the Muslim Brotherhood kind of in place, in their view, in place in strategic locations and places in the United States, they can rise up and they can take the place of Western democracy in the United States. And they truly believe that one day Islam is going to the caliphate will not just be the caliphate of the Middle East like it had in the past. I mean, their view is a global caliphate. Their view is that the supremacy of Islam will take over the capitals of London and the United States and China and Russia and everywhere else.
Yeah, and they made no bones about this, those that you did have on camera. This was very clearly their agenda. But just to go back to this question, because I think one of the great defects of our own government's handling of this threat here inside the United States as well as elsewhere has been we've credited the Muslim Brotherhood's various operatives and organizations in this country with their claim that they've eschewed violence. And we've ignored completely the sort of stealthy, subversive form of jihad, this civilization jihad, as it's been called, that they are working aggressively until such time as they're strong enough to do the violent kind. Does that track with your understanding of the program?
It does. You and I may separate a little bit here. I totally agree that is their goal. We may separate a little bit in the sense that I don't think it is particularly effective. They're trying hard, and they are aggressively expanding into the West, and they are aggressively expanding into areas of influence where they could have a perch to have some impact. But I really don't think that from a cultural perspective, they have made a number of gains, by the way. And I'm not arguing that, but I don't think that they're a threat to us in terms of having some kind of cultural takeover or be in a position where they can do significant cultural damage to us. I mean, we now see in the examples, you know, they also made no bones. And one of the more interesting and shocking parts of the video was when I was interviewing this agent of the Muslim Brotherhood who's in Southern California, half a mile away from one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. And he said to me, look, we work very closely with the left. The left are, these are his words, the left are our allies.
I mean, hold the thought, because that's sure. A topic I want to get into next. We'll be right back with much more with Ami Horowitz right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting with Ami Horowitz, a filmmaker extraordinaire, among other feats he's accomplished over his years. Ami, I did just want to come back to this question of in addition to the Brotherhood being unmistakably sort of Sharia supremacist program and institution worldwide that is seeking, where possible, through violence to achieve the dominance of its Sharia organizing doctrine. But you've sort of downplayed what I think I would argue is what it is doing most insidiously, particularly in this country and definitely in Western Europe, namely its effort to sort of advance through more stealthy means, the accommodations that enable, for example, speech to be suppressed because it's blasphemy. And the idea that Muslims are victims and Islamophobia are all being used to sort of promote this idea that endless concessions must be made in order to have sort of tranquility with the Muslim community. And I just would like to make sure that if I'm missing something, you make that clear. If I haven't seen the film quite the way I thought I had, that's also clear. But isn't this part of what you have addressed in your interviews with these guys is that the agenda of domination, of submission by the rest of the world to Sharia is to be accomplished in whatever means are at hand, and stealthy, subversive political action is one of the techniques that's employed until such time as violence is possible.
All right, so let me clarify what my point was. What I don't believe is that we're in danger of an Islamic takeover of the United States. What I do believe is that they have very successfully been able to change the agenda of a lot of the left. And what I mean by that is they have been able to successfully move. Now, you know, it's funny. When you look at the left and what the left's supposed beliefs are, and you look at, you know, Islamic radicals like the Brotherhood and their beliefs, that you would think they're incompatible with one another. There's no way they could be allies. But what radical Islam in general has really successfully done has been able to find a way to align themselves with the left. And don't get too far in the weeds, but it all comes from this notion of intersectionality, which is taken over the left, that the notion that all people who are victims are bonded in this kind of perverse way. And since the left looks at Islam as victims of, you know, horrible, big Western supremacies like the United States, then they have found them to have a connection with one another. And they've allowed the doctrines of Islamic radicalism and the Muslim Brotherhood to infiltrate their doctrine of anti-Semitism, their doctrine of the hate of the West, their doctrines that have essentially aligned themselves bizarrely well with the left. You look at the Women's March, you look at Linda Sarsour, who's a leader of the Women's March, right? This woman is an open anti-Semite. This woman is an open hater of the United States of America. Her uncle, by the way, is actually a leader in the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't know what her personal beliefs are. I imagine they're pretty aligned, but her uncle is a significant leader in the Muslim Brotherhood here in the United States. And in that sense, they have had a significant cultural impact because they have moved the agenda of the left. In fact, they've moved the agenda now. And I used to separate the left and the Democrats, but the Democrats have more and more been aligned with the left side of the party as opposed to the center left of their party. So in that sense, I agree with you completely that they've had a significant impact on the politics and the policies of the Democrats and the left.
Right.
Does that help better explain it?
Yes, I think that's really getting to the heart of what I'm concerned about is that the mutations that we're seeing that are either aligning the country with their agenda or at least inducing political parties and politicians, frankly, of both parties, to make concessions to this clearly hostile agenda and group is the very worrying thing. Hey, I did want to just come back to the point that I made a moment ago about you're being a courageous guy. I think one of the things that jumped out at you, if you look at this film Inside the Muslim Brotherhood, Ami, is you are really putting yourself in some personal jeopardy in some cases. There was a scene in particular on the streets of, I think it was Cairo, where you were talking to some of the Brotherhood's admirers, if not operatives. Tell us a little bit about, the environment that you found yourself in as that interview proceeded.
It's funny. Yeah, it was – so this was a Muslim Brotherhood – there's a number of Muslim Brotherhood neighborhoods throughout Egypt, but in Cairo in particular. And it was I remember it clearly because it was first of all like 115 degrees out. It was also during Ramadan, so my crew they weren't strict Muslims, but they kind of kept Ramadan, so nobody was drinking water. And if for me, I was not gonna not drink water, so I kind of had to I had a bottle of water. I had to lay down the bottom of the van and drink my water so nobody could see me. Because if I was drinking water out publicly, things would get bad real quick. And what happened was, it started off as I kind of do most of my man in the street stuff, kind of stopping people and asking questions, and everything proceeded fine for the first hour or so. But then I think people started getting wind of my agenda, and at one point, there's this one kid I was talking to. He kind of was getting a group of people riled up, and they were kind of behind me in the camera. And this group was kind of getting a little bit, I couldn't tell because I was kind of focused on this interview with this kid, but my camera guy and my crew, they started getting very, very nervous. And at one point the crowd was kind of riling up this kid, and the kid looked at the crowd, and he kind of made a slashing on the throat sign and pointed at me. And at that moment I was like, I think our time on camera, I think our time is up here, and I think it's time for us to skedaddle. And we were able to get away, thank God, unharmed. There was another time where I was in Beirut. I was in Beirut about three times for this documentary, and I was interviewing this one guy in particular. And when I do these things, I have a legend. I kind of create a person that doesn't really exist, but they kind of are attracted to, and that's why they're willing to talk to me. I pretend to be kind of a left-wing, self-hating Jew, and they love that guy. So they're usually happy to talk to that guy. And usually there's no problems, but in discussion in the pre-interview, before we actually do the interview itself, my spidey sense start tingling. I thought to myself, this guy isn't buying what I'm selling. I can tell just based on our discussion and the way I've done this enough times where I can see somebody's body movements. I get a sense of whether or not they feel comfortable with me or uncomfortable. And this guy clearly felt uncomfortable with me. And he kept talking to people, whispering them in his ear, people work for him, and they kept bringing more people into the room. And I started getting very, very nervous because, I do a lot, I interview Hamas, Islamic Jihad. When I'm in the Palestinian territories, for example, if something, God forbid, bad happens there, Israel is able to get into those areas. They have control of those areas. They can, I feel like they can grab me. in a place like Beirut in Lebanon, or I was in the Bekaa Valley also, that's a place where the U.S. or Israel cannot grab me or help me. So if they grab you there, you're on your own. And I just felt like this was not a comfortable situation. This was not a safe space, Frank. And by the way, that's the definition of not a safe space, just so we're all agreed on what that means. That's really what not a safe space means.
Authentically unsafe.
Yeah. Not when somebody says something uncomfortable to you. So I said, let me go to the bathroom, and I jumped out a second-story window to get the hell out of there.
Good for you. Well, listen, there was one other chap, and you alluded to him a moment ago, who isn't in Beirut or in the Bekaa Valley or even on the West Bank. He's, as you say, a few miles from one of the most beautiful beaches in the world. Some of that beach is, if I'm not mistaken, is occupied by one of our most important marine military bases in Southern California, is it not? Talk a little bit about this character and what your takeaway was from your interview with him.
Yeah, this guy's name is Sakar, S-A-K-R. He's an interesting cat. He is an Egyptian, although just bizarre, and it shows you kind of their, you know, I like to say that sometimes that when it comes to radical Islam, the only liberal relationship in their life is with the truth. They're very fast and loose with truth. And, you know, a perfect example of that is I'm interviewing this guy and I go, where are you from? He's a very, very thick Middle Eastern accent. He goes, oh, I was born in Providence, Rhode Island. I'm like, seriously? Are you really trying to sell us on that? In any case, this guy, Sakar, this character is Egyptian, and he's actually wanted by the Egyptian police and military for murdering you know, ostensibly, apparently, according to them, a police officer, and he ran off and came to the United States. His wife actually is a teacher in the California school system, and this guy, he, you know, I was shocked. Now he's very, very difficult to interview. It was hard to get him to agree to go on camera. I know a lot of people on our side have tried to get him to interview him or even find him. And he's been very difficult to find. We were able to track him down and I was able to convince him to sit down with me on camera. And then I was shocked how open he was about his agenda. Like, he really let it out in the open. I mean, this guy was saying, I hate America. I want to see American destruction. I will die. These are the words he used. I will die to see American destruction. And it would be one of the greatest deaths I can imagine myself having. Now, if that doesn't sound like a guy who's gearing up for something pretty terrible, I don't know what does.
Yeah, no.
And by the way, I hope the U.S. government takes some kind of action.
Well, I would hope so, too. I mean, why he's in this country in the first place is an open question, I guess. But secondly, you know, this seems like as much of a ticking time bomb as you could expect to see. And Ami, we have to stop for one more moment. We'll be right back with our final segment with the great Ami Horowitz. We'll talk a little bit about his political platform for the 2020 elections.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Ami Horowitz, a very gutsy and, well, he says gonzo journalist who has been incredibly effective in showcasing troubles in our world that you need to know about, and you're not likely to find out much about them elsewhere, I'm sorry to say. Ami, we won't probably have time to do justice to either of these topics, but I did want to talk about the Stockholm Syndrome film and what you accomplished as a result of really an extraordinary bit of reporting on that. And then at least just give you a shout out for your incredibly intrepid reporting about the United Nations in UN and me. But start with the Stockholm Syndrome, if you would.
Yeah, this was before Sweden was elevated on the national scene because of what the debate is happening on their Islamic immigration. As we all know, a couple of years ago, 3-4 years ago, that Europe was taking an incredible amount of refugees onto its shores. Germany, obviously, was being highlighted among the most for taking in the most numbers of Islamic refugees, and there have been incredible problems in Germany because of that. We've seen France been doing it for a long time. Their problems have been been well documented, unfortunately. And Germany, we're seeing similar problems cropping up. And the Syrian refugees are kind of a new phenomenon for them, although they have a history with Turkish refugees. But what was unknown by most was that Sweden has taken in far, far more refugees than any country in Europe on a per capita basis. They essentially went from zero population, Islamic population, to 6%, 7%, 8%, depending on the numbers, in just a few short years. And at the same time, there was an incredible amount of social upheaval because of this influx of Islamic refugees. And in particular, the rates in murder and the rates in rape were skyrocketing over that same period of time. If you look at a graph of both those things, they kind of mirror each other. In addition to that, it was a country that didn't really know gun violence. And with that same period of time, the police were telling me on camera that maybe they saw, a use of guns, maybe one time a month, and now they're seeing three, four times a week.
And there's not just a correlation between the fact that there are a lot more immigrants and this kind of problem behavior was taking place, but that the immigrants were actually responsible for the violent activities. No.
Yeah. It's interesting. The statistics are very, very clear, despite what the left and some of the mainstream media who tried to discredit me would say. Oddly enough, they were trying to say there is no rise in rape when Swedish statistics are just as clear as day. There is no there's no debate, or there shouldn't be a debate on whether or not rape is up. One can debate the cause of the rape, but to debate whether rape is up was a bizarre argument that people were making. The Swedish crime keeper of the statistics used to keep, a number of years ago, the demographics of the people committing these acts of violence and rape. And not shockingly, immigrants were always on the top of the list of people who were committing these crimes. And then for some bizarre reason, a few years ago, that line, the statistic, just kind of left. Don't know why. And then they started arguing, well, we can't see any correlation between the two because we don't keep those kind of numbers. Now, there are a number of ways to kind of do workarounds to see who was in fact responsible. And it became clear and clear that in fact it was Islamic refugees that were committing the majority of these acts of violence against women and others.
So you were able to chronicle this in your film, The Stockholm Syndrome. And what came of that in Sweden?
So it was incredible. And I'll tell you, it was a Saturday night. I'll never forget it. And I was at a bar mitzvah and somebody emailed me, "Hey, I think the president just referenced your video." And I was like, "Oh, okay. That's interesting." And I kind of just looked it up and I saw that he did. In fact, he said, "Look what happened." He misspoke. At the time, I didn't think much of it. He said, "Look what happened last night in Sweden." What he meant to say was, "Look what happened. I saw this video last night. Look what's happening in Sweden." That's what he meant to say. It didn't come out that way. He just misspoke. And of course, many of you remember the world just exploded. And I know I woke up I wasn't thinking much of it till I woke up on Sunday morning. My wife's like, "Yeah, you got to see what's happening out there." And I was like, "What do you mean?" Front page New York Times, front page of every paper in the world, really. And the way the thing kind of, it's really fascinating. The way the thing kind of tracked was the first day, that Sunday, it was mostly about what he said and said, "This is crazy. This is stupid." Then the next day the Monday was when they realized he was referring to my video. And then I was on the front page of all these papers. And that literally for 48 hours, every 15 minutes of the beginning of every hour on CNN, every hour for 48 hours, the headline chiron 15 minutes was "Documentary creates global controversy." And
you can't buy advertising like that.
Oh, no. But the most important part of this whole debate was twofold. One was it did in fact create a debate on whether or not Islamic immigration into Western countries is a good thing or a bad thing. Is it detrimental or is it helpful or is it benign? This is a debate we were not having before. But we were to a certain extent. I'm sorry, that's not true. We were. But it really became a fierce debate after this thing happened. And even more important than that, and this thing I'm most proud of, is that Sweden went from increasing its Islamic immigration by 50% every year to the year after the video came out, they have cut it not quite to zero, but close to zero. And they have kept that number ever since.
And let me just hasten to add, Ami, I think this is implicit in what you're saying here. It's not that the problem was that people were Islam or Muslim per se. It was that they were bringing with them this propensity for, if not actual embrace of, this Sharia supremacist program, which is so antithetical to Western societies and civilizations and freedoms and rights. And that's where things were really coming a cropper in Sweden and so many other places. But listen, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I did just want to give you an opportunity. This is not a political show. This is not brought to you by an organization that engages in politics, but I did want to just invite you to talk a little bit about, you know, the vision that you have going into this maelstrom of the 2020 presidential election as a candidate for the Democratic nomination for president.
It just sounds bizarre every time somebody says it. I've heard it a thousand times, and it doesn't get less bizarre when I hear that. But yes, so I have thrown my hat into the ring to become the Democratic nominee for president. I'll be honest, we haven't had the amount of traction I would have liked to have had at this point. We tried, essentially the point of it was, the gag of it was to get me on the Democratic debate stage. And, there was actually a number of dirty tricks that the DNC, because this thing did create a lot of controversy when we first announced, and it got a lot of press when we first announced. And the DNC actually created a whole bunch of dirty tricks to make sure we didn't qualify, including kicking us off the platform that everybody else uses to raise money. There was a whole bunch of stuff that went on. So they succeeded in the sense where we didn't qualify. But the truth was is that this campaign was able it gave me the ability to get on a number of platforms to say to their own faces that the Democratic Party is destroying itself, and that the Democratic Party ever sniffed the presidency again in the near future, we'll be in a very tough situation. The Democratic Party has moved so far. It's funny that the Democratic Party's belief system now is what right-wing conspiratorialists were saying about them 10 years ago. Like they would, people would say, this is a country, this is a party that believes in open borders. I'm like, come on, it's ridiculous. They don't believe in open borders. I mean, they might be a little more liberal. This is a country that believes that everybody should have late-term abortions. I'm like, come on, that's ridiculous. They don't really believe that. I mean, maybe a couple people. This is a country that believes in socialism. I'm like, God, relax, relax. They don't believe in socialism. They're a little bit more, tax and spend. Well, guess what? All those turned out to be true. They are the party of socialism. They're the party of late-term abortion. They're the party of open borders. They want to decriminalize people coming across a border illegally. This is insane, Frank. And I have to get on a stage and I have to say it because it is absolutely crazy.
It is crazy. And if it were just crazy, it would be one thing. It's dangerous. And I'm a big believer in, a real competition in the political space. I commend you. I'm always appreciative of good people getting in the arena, as Teddy Roosevelt said. And especially, Ami, you bring so much intelligence and thoughtful analysis of the major public policy issues of our time. Hope you'll come back to us again very soon. God bless you in the meantime. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.